Okay, we're in two special time periods right now in Elul. The first time period is the 7 weeks from after Tisha B'Av until Rosh Hashanah. That's called the Shiva D'Nechemta, the 7 weeks of consolation. And we call it the 7 weeks of consolation because we've come from the big breakup of Tisha B'Av, the saddest day of the year, to the day of judgment, to a shifting in our relationship with God. And we need these 7 weeks of consolation to bring us from mourning to hope, really. So during these 7 weeks, each one of the Haftorahs, the reading after the Torah reading, is from the book of Isaiah, and it's about consolation. So each Haftorah is a consoling Haftorah, prophecies of redemption and the future, and the Jewish people are going to be treated more nicely, and you're going to see everything's going to work out well, and you know, you thought you were barren, and now you have lots of children, and you thought you were miserable, and now you're so happy, and all the misery that you went through was like just a drop in the bucket compared to all the joy that awaits. So think about all the misery we went through. It's a lot. And hopefully that is going to be like a drop in the bucket compared to what it's going to be like when we turn the corner on that. So that's one stream that's going through right now, which we'll talk about in a minute. And on top of that, beginning with Rosh Chodesh Elul, the beginning of Elul, through to Rosh Hashanah, we have another layer on top of that, which is the energy of Elul itself. So we have two streams. We're right now in the middle of two streams of energy. So the stream of consolation, let's talk about that for a second. What is consolation? Consolation is a shifting of perspective. Right? So when you go to console a mourner, you can't bring back their dead. You can't really make them feel better, but you can help them shift perspective a little bit. Try to put it into some context. I appreciate that they lived, learned a lot. I really miss them, but you know, I can live without them. Whatever it is, there's a shift in perspective. That's a consolation. So it's in that, in mourning, it's also used for a changing of the mind. So let's say in the book of Jonah, where Jonah's yelling at God in the end of the book, and he takes him to task. Jonah takes God to task. Hi. Jonah takes God to task for not destroying Nineveh. He's so upset, right? And he says, I can't believe it. You didn't destroy it. You're a God who just changes your mind, right? Changes your mind about the bad. He says, V'nichum al hara. You changed your mind about the bad. You said you were going to destroy them, and you didn't. You were minachem. You changed your mind, right? So the word nichum, or nachem, linachem, nechemta, does mean a changing of the mind. So we'll look back at the Jonah story, but it does mean a shifting of perspective. So we have a shift of perspective happening here, and at the same time, we have Elul right now. So Elul, who knows where the names of our Hebrew months come from? Where do we find them?
The Romans? That's what?
Is it Babylonian?
Yes. You said Shirashirim, which I'll tell you why you said that in just a minute, but it is Babylonian. The names of the months in the Torah are just ordinal. We have the first month and the second month and the third month and the, you know, but we don't have any names. They have numbers. But it wasn't until the Babylonian exile when the months got names. But in the Torah, they're just called by numbers. So the names are just names. They don't really mean anything, but we love to give meaning to stuff, so we will. So Elul, right? Elul is used as Rosh Tevot, as an acronym kind of a name. So Elul stands for Ani Ledodi Vedodi Li. I am to my beloved, and my beloved is to me. That's from Shir HaShirim, so that's why it brought that to mind. But there's lots of different things that are used to weave into the name. One of them is also Ish L'Re'ehu Matanot Le'Evyonim, right? You should give gifts. That's from Purim. You should give gifts to one person for another, and you should give gifts to the poor, right? So both of those sentences, one is about lovers being for each other, and one is about friends being for each other. They're both about a coming together, right? So we are coming together during this period in different ways. We talk about, the king is in the field, right? If we lived in a kingdom and we wanted to speak to the king, you really can't have access to the king. He's in the palace. You're just a peasant somewhere. But Elul is the month when he rides in his carriage and he goes into the fields and he walks among the people. And you can approach the king and ask him whatever you want. That's the ancient, Hasidic type of a parable. We don't have that anymore. Obama doesn't come to the field. So
it's on TV now.
It's on TV. So you get to see him, but you don't get to talk.
Talking about ISIL.
Yes. So you could tweet the president, maybe. Well, I guess on Reddit they have AMAs. That's kind of the king is in the field. I don't know if anybody's on Reddit or knows what that is. I actually don't, but I have a son who does, so I've watched him. And AMA is Ask Me Anything. So he loves to go on when, let's say, Neil deGrasse Tyson, a scientist, goes on. And it's AMA for an hour. You can ask him anything. You have access to ask him anything. And you see the questions that are posted and he answers. So there's AMAs with people. So that's as close as we get to the king is in the field, you know, where you have access to somebody big. Right? But that's what Elul is about, is an AMA with God the whole month, right? So ask me anything. So you don't necessarily get answers, but you get to talk to God. We're in a much closer time. Of course, you can talk to God anytime, but this is a time of extra closeness. That is part of the energy in this month, is the energy of creation. The energy of creation of closeness and the energy of shifting of perspectives. So shifting of perspectives in the Nichum, in the consolation weeks, and then shifting a perspective and coming extra close as a lover with God and with our fellow as well. So we talk about different relationships that we have with God. We refer to God as the king. So king, we have king, subject, master, servant, parent, child, right? What other ones do we have that are top down? Somebody in charge, somebody underneath. So those are most of the ways that we talk about God. There's one way that is on par, and that's the Shir HaShirim way of talking about God as a lover. Lovers in a relationship that relationship is only as strong as the lowest common denominator. And you can leave at any time, right? You're only lovers as long as you both agree to be lovers. Parent and child in relationship, whether or not you agree, whether or not it's pleasant, right? You're in it, even if it's bad, right? And king subject, you can't get out of it, right? The king can't easily abdicate, but the subject can never get out of it, right? Master servant, servant stuck. But lovers, you can leave at any time. It's interesting that in Jewish law, we learn the laws of divorce before we learn the laws of marriage. In the book, in the order of the books, divorce comes before marriage. Why is that? What do you think?
Know how to get out of something before you get in.
Right. You should know how to get out of something before you get in, but also that strengthens marriages. You might think it weakens marriages because right away you're opening up a pathway for exit. But it actually strengthens marriages because if you know you could leave, you could stay. You know, so you'll leave tomorrow if you need to leave because there is an exit strategy. But, and then if you choose to stay, every day that you stay is because you chose it. So every day that you're married is because you both chose to stay married. That day, and hopefully you'll choose the next day, but you could get out. It's interesting, my husband, when he was 17, at that time the drinking age was 18, but at 17 he got a job illegally working for a liquor warehouse, loading boxes onto a truck, right? So a bunch of Catholic guys in unionized New York, but he was the son of one of the vice presidents, so he got the job, right? So he's loading boxes on the truck. They stop for a lunch break, and all the guys are sitting around, New York Catholic guys, right? And one of the guys comes in and says he's engaged. And he said, oh, you're engaged. Whoa, who are you engaged to? He said, you know, to Maria. She's so beautiful. I love her. And the guy said, oh, what, you're marrying for love? You should marry one of your father's paisano's daughters. He said, first you love her, then she love you. Then you don't love her, then she don't love you, and then you have to get a gun or a divorce or something. So that's Catholic. You have to get a gun or a divorce or something, because they don't have a divorce. You're not allowed to get divorced in Catholic. You get married and you're stuck for life, right? So you have to get a gun first before a divorce. So clearly that's stuck in his mind because it's part of my mind now, and I didn't even know him then. But so we learn about divorce first. So the point is, though, that lovers are in relationship both by choice, which keeps you on par. So it's actually considered the holiest of all relationships, which is why Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is considered the holiest of all our holy texts on the Kabbalistic level. It's very deeply holy. If you read it, it's very deeply sensual. You know, it really is talking about lovers, and the fair hair and the lovely curves, the whole thing can make you blush. So, but it is about the attraction of lovers. So that's what we're trying to do, is ani le dodi ve dodi li. I am to my beloved, and my beloved is to me. We're trying to create this relationship of deep enjoyment and pleasure in our relationship with the divine, and also with our fellow. That's the energy of the month of Elul. So how do we do that? How do we take the energy of Elul and take the energy of Nichum and create closeness? So the first thing that we have to do is bridge the gaps. We have to repair the breaks that we made throughout the year. Right? So that's the tshuva process. Right? We have a tshuva process, returning back to our essence. So the tshuva process involves returning to who we actually are. When we say in the morning, Elokai neshama shena tata bi taharahi, my God, the soul that you gave me is pure. You should know that is a declaration of Jewish faith that does not exist in other religions. So just speaking not from the broadest background, my husband always thinks I'm an expert in Christianity, but the truth is I left it when I was 10. So everything I learned about Christianity is basically from Tuvia Singer. So it's not from church. But I know that if you're a Christian, you are born a sinner. You're born a sinner that needs redemption. And if you're a Jew, you are born pure. You're born pure and beautiful and holy, and you can make mistakes. And you can tarnish your neshama, and you can heap garbage on top of your neshama. But you can't taint your neshama. It's still pure. You can just throw off the garbage and polish it up, and it will shine beautifully. So that's a huge difference between the paradigms of both, is how we view the essence of the human being. So we view the essence of the human being a pure, beautiful, shining soul. That makes mistakes. For sure it's going to make mistakes. We have this concept of Ein tzaddik ba'aretz asher lo yechta. There's no such thing as a holy person in the land that won't sin. Everybody sins. So for that, God made a redemption process. No problem. There's tshuva. Turns out that tshuva has to be there for repairing the breaches. You can't offer a sacrifice and have that work if you don't do tshuva. You can't have somebody do something on your behalf and have that work if there's no tshuva. The goat that goes to Azazel doesn't work if you didn't do tshuva. The offerings that are offered for the community don't work if you don't do tshuva. The private offerings that you might bring in temple times don't work if you don't do tshuva. Tshuva is the essential ingredient. So how do we do that? What is the tshuva process? Lucky for you, I happen to bring a translation of the Rambam. We tell us what it is. Okay, I'm just going to read you the first. So Rambam, everybody knows what that is, right?
Maimonides.
Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, so we have Rambam, Maimonides, and he basically took the entire Gemara, which has ideas sprinkled all around it, and it's required to learn the whole thing to be able to get a handle on any one subject. You have to kind of know the whole thing. He felt that's impractical. Maybe you just want to look up the laws of doing tshuva. So he was the first one to rewrite the Gemara, basically, and categorize all the information into his Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah has 14 volumes, so it's also called the Yad HaChazaka. Yad is 14. The word for hand is Yud Dalet is 14. Yud is 10 and Dalet is 4. That spells hand, but it's also 14. It's 14 volumes, so it's called the Yad HaChazaka. In his Yad HaChazaka, his 14 books, he has different subjects, and in one of them is the Laws of Doing Tshuva. The Laws of Doing Tshuva has 10 chapters. There's 10 days of repentance, so it's considered meritorious to read one chapter each of the 10 days of repentance, or to learn these laws before Rosh Hashanah, so you'll know what's coming up, right? So here's the opening part of it. If a person transgresses any of the mitzvot of the Torah, whether a positive command or a negative command, whether willingly or inadvertently, when he repents and returns from his sin, he must confess before God, blessed be he, as Numbers 5, 6 to 7 states, if a man or a woman commit any of the sins of man, they must confess the sin that they committed. This refers to a verbal confession. The confession is a positive command. Confession. Not Catholic confession, Jewish confession. It's between you and God alone. But you have to say it out loud. So he goes on to explain how you do it. But basically there's a three-step process for tshuva. So the first step is to stop doing the sin. Second step is to regret it. The third step is to confess. Right? So we have those three steps: stop, regret, confess. In those three steps, there's a 3.5, there's a half, and there's a 4. So the 3.5 step is stop, regret, if your sin was against, 2.5, sorry, if your sin was against somebody else, stole from them, you have to return the money and apologize and get their forgiveness, and then confess to God. So you have to repair the damage that you did. But let's say your sin is against God. You ate treif, right? I stop eating treif. I feel bad that I ate treif. I tell God, I'm sorry, I ate treif, right? Now you're done. Except for really, the half step is you have to recognize that you shouldn't be eating that. What if it's like kind of medium? You're not quite sure. What if you made a mistake? You ate Milchik cookies after Fleishik's, right? Not the biggest sin in the world, but you're not supposed to do that, right? So you say, oh, I'm sorry. I realize I shouldn't be doing that. I made a mistake. So you first have to realize it and then stop doing it. So realizing is the half step, right? And then stop doing it and then regret it and then confess. Really, the fourth step is to take upon yourself not to do it again, right? And figure out a way for that to not happen. Oh, from now on, before I eat cookies, I'm going to read the ingredients each time, or whatever it is, or I'm going to mark the things that are dairy more carefully when I bring them in my house so everybody sees it, or whatever it is, you figure out a way, right? I feel bad that I yell at my kids too much. So first you have to apologize to your kids. I'm sorry, I yelled at you too much this year. I'm really going to try harder to keep my voice lower. Please forgive me for yelling at you so much this year. Then they say, yes, I forgive you. Elul's a great time to ask for that. Because this is a time of people coming together. There is an energy here of repair and restoration and renewal of relationships that you can use. So even if you had a big blow up with your mother-in-law in March, and you weren't able to ask her for forgiveness then, this is the time. You can pick up the phone and say, Ma, it's Elul. It's a time of repairing relationships. I'm really sorry for what happened last March. Will you please forgive me? It's much easier to say it in Elul than it is in March. So better you should say it in March or April. But if you didn't, Elul is the time. You definitely want to take care of those big problems that you have before Rosh Hashanah. Because Hashem is our shadow and behaves like we behave. And so to the extent that we forgive others, that we seek repair, that we create repair, Hashem's energy can come into the world in the repairing way, in the restoring way, in the way that we want it to. But He follows us. He has chosen to follow us. So that is the tshuva process, basically, is stop doing it, regret doing it. So you have to actually have a change of heart and confess. Say it out loud. God, I'm sorry that I ate treif. I commit to not do it again. Done. You're done. And now you're done. Now it's repaired, if you really meant it. It's repaired and you can move on. A lot of people, I just did a little bit of a support conversation for Jews by Choice and Jews by Birth. So I'll tell you a place where Jews by Choice can get hung up, Jews by Birth can get hung up in this, which is not forgiving themselves. Everybody cannot forgive themselves, but there's a lot of guilt in the Jewish community. And Jews by Choice from Protestant backgrounds have less Jewish guilt than Jews by Choice from Catholic backgrounds who understand guilt. Right? So there's this whole guilt thing that happens in the Jewish community. That's just part of Jewish heritage of not forgiving yourself or others often. And after you finish tshuva, you can forgive yourself. There's actually a question theologically. Why on Yom Kippur, when we get forgiveness after the whole day of Yom Kippur, you fasted, you prayed, you're completely forgiven, your slate is wiped clean. Before you break your fast, you daven Maariv of the new year, that first Maariv, right? That Maariv has an Al-Chait in it. I'm sorry I sinned before you, God. Wait a second, you just finished Yom Kippur. Your slate is wiped clean. What are you saying Al-Chait for, right, at all? Maybe you didn't forgive yourself.
It's communal also then.
Yes.
Maybe right. Somebody didn't.
Right, it's possible that somebody else didn't, and we do get to say Al-Chait for everybody. There is a communal thing for sure. But why should you say Al-Chait Shechatati, right? It's not Shechatanu at this point, Shechatati, well, the sin that I did, maybe it's because we didn't forgive ourselves. But you're right, there's other people who did not do the work. And so we're all connected to each other.
Later times though, where they've already gone out.
And already done something. Good, that's good. This year I was privileged to be in Australia for 2 weeks, And I was in Australia for Tisha B'Av. If you can manage it, try it. It's in the winter. And it ended at 10 to 6. How great is that? To have a fast day, be 50 degrees, and end at 10 to 6. You don't even get thirsty or hungry, and you get to break the fast. Like, you're peckish for breakfast. You'd like your coffee, but pretty soon the fast is over. It's great. So, but it was weird to, think. I was, eating way ahead of everybody else in the world, because it's 16 hours ahead of Denver. So it was just a weird thing. And then, so I flew home the day after Tisha B'Av. And then some rabbi came over to me and said, oh, so you don't hold by the Chazon Ish's Shita, that once you take off from the ground, you're actually in the day before, according to the date line of the Chazon Ish, so you'd really be in Tisha B'Av. I'm like, I didn't know about that, Shita. Now you're confusing everything. He was like, yeah, that's why I never fly on Sundays, because then you're flying back into Shabbos, and it's on Shabbos, you're flying on Shabbos. I'm like, because I always fly on Mondays. I'm like, oh, good.
So you had
good.
It, fast again?
So it turns out not everybody holds by it. So I don't hold by that Shita.
But there is. Japan, you'd have to
I know,
days.
Right? So no, you don't have to do that, but some people would fast again, even though they broke their fast at night and had breakfast in the morning and then got on the plane at noon. They would fast from when they got on the plane until they crossed the international dateline and they're back outside of Tisha B'Av. Right. I chose not to take that on. Yeah, yeah.
You do the same thing like you said on Shabbos, too. You have to be careful.
Right. So, yeah, it's a strange thing.
Depending which way
you fly. Right. No, if you're flying back.
It's only if you're flying back.
If you're flying back.
Because you're flying towards, you miss a day.
Right.
So that was the other weird thing. So we had one week of Shabbos that were 5 days apart, and the next week of Shabbos that were 8 days apart. Right? Because you miss a whole day flying there, so you make Shabbos on the 6th day after your last Shabbos. And then when you fly back, you make Shabbos on the 8th 24-hour period after your last Shabbos. So, yeah, it's weird. The whole time zone thing is interesting halachically. Okay. So we have this concept of tshuva, of repairing the relationship with God and repairing the relationship with others, and that there's an energy inherent in this month. But what is that energy? Right? Why? How can we do that repair? How does it really work? Okay, those are the halachic steps, but how does it actually function? How do you access that energy? You know, on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah, we say, please, God, don't judge me. You're going to be judged, right? But you don't want to be judged out of justice. You want to be judged out of mercy, right? So we say, please, God, get off your kisei hadin. Please arise from your throne of justice and move over and judge me from your throne of mercy, from your kisei harachamim. How can we ask that of God, though? We're saying, God, please turn a blind eye. Don't really look at what I did. It seems like that, and that's where Jonah was so frustrated with God. Jonah, who knows, this is extra bonus points for anybody who knows this, but I bet somebody does. What was Jonah's last name? Jonah Ben... Avery is his description of himself. That's good. Jonah Ben Amittai. That's his father's name, Amittai. It's Jonah Ben Amittai. So, what is Amittai? It's Emet, right? He's Jonah, the son of truth. Jonah, the son of truth. Okay, so that makes a big difference. Go through the whole story, and, he gets the prophecy, doesn't want to give the prophecy, runs away, he's in the fish, he's out of the fish, he's in the next fish, he's thrown up on the shore, off he goes to Tarshish, gives the prophecy, doesn't want to give the prophecy, but he gives the prophecy. The whole city's going to be turned over, and then what? They do tshuva. And now they're not turned over. He is ticked. He can't believe it. So angry that he wants to die. He goes into his little sukkah and says, God, kill me now because I have had it with this whole thing. I just want to be dead. I don't want to be alive in the face of you not doing what you said you were going to do. That's what it says straight up in the text. That's not Midrash. That is paraphrasing the actual text. He is mad at God. And he accuses God. He says, I so didn't want to bring this prophecy because I knew you are a kel rachum v'chanun. Erech ha'paim rav chesed ve. Do you recognize his words? Mm-hmm. What should be the next word?
Emet.
Right? Because I knew. These are the 13 midos harachamim, the 13 qualities of mercy of God. He uses them accusingly at God. He says, God, I knew it. You're a merciful God. You're Kel Rachum V'Chanun, Erech Apayim Rav Chesed V'Nichum Al Hara. You change your mind about the bad stuff. That's who you are. You're not a God of truth. You're a God of changing your mind. That's who you are. Kill me now. I don't want to be the subject of a God who changes his mind. I am Jonah ben Amittai. I'm the God. I'm the son of truth. And I want to see truth in my God, not mind changing. That's his tirade against God. He is ticked off, right? Then God grows the leaf and takes away the leaf. And it's such a weird ending of the book, right? And God says, what, you like the leaf? And I shouldn't like my cattle and people? That's the end. It's a very Jewish ending. He answers a question with a question. That's it. You're done. Okay. What do we get out of that, though? What we get is Jonah's question is about truth. How can it be true that you're saying, A, the city wasn't turned over? Well, first of all, God could answer because he's a dafkanik, turns out, like some of us are. Do you know what a dafkanik is, everybody? Somebody who split hairs, right? So a dafkanik, it's a great Jewish word to know. Dafka means just so, just because. So I'll tell you a dafkanik story just so you could understand what that means. I was in the bungalow colonies in the Catskills. It was a rainy, muddy Friday afternoon. The kids were in and out. The floor was a disaster. But I got them all in the tub, all cleaned up. And meanwhile, I washed the whole floor by hand, small floor, but it was spotless, right? Now it's like 2 o'clock. The kids are in their Shabbos clothes. And maybe 4 o'clock, whatever. And a little girl comes over, 7 years old, and she's wearing these boots that are caked in mud, right? She knocks on the door. I open the door, and I say, wait, stop right there. Do not come into this bungalow with those muddy feet. And she looks at me and she says, my feet are not muddy. I said, look at them. They're covered in mud. She said, my boots are muddy. My feet are clean. That's being a dafkanik, okay? So that's what God said. He said, I did turn over the city. It turned over through tshuva. That's what kapara is. Kapara is flipping something. So that you can actually, there's a process. Through that tshuva process, you actually take, if you think about the road of life and journeying along on it, and think about your sins as potholes, right? You can take that entire road and just flip it like that. So that every one of those mistakes you made becomes a merit through tshuva. Right? So it's turned over. So the city was turned over through tshuva, not through destruction. But Jonah is upset about it, and he doesn't feel like that's from a place of truth. So let's look at what is that place of truth. So what we say is, please, God, don't judge us through justice. Justice is harsh. Justice is examining. Justice can be mean, and I actually don't want to face the consequences of what I did or the consequences of what I didn't do. I'd rather have a very soft judgment. Just give me another year, and it should be nice. Right? My kids should behave well. I should have good income. I should lose weight without actually having to try. You know, all that stuff. In a healthy way. Right? So, right? That's what we want. So, we just want that softness. But how could we possibly ask for that given our history? So we say, please don't judge me that way. Please judge me through rachamim. So rachamim, right? Rachamim, mercy, could be like, don't look at what I did. Just be nice. Right? Just be nice. That's what we ask an earthly judge to judge. Don't look. Okay, I did bad stuff, but really I can't bear the punishment of it. So just let me off the hook. So that's not truth. So, but we have to be asking God. God's seal is truth. That's what he is that he's the God of truth. So we can't ask him to do something that's not true. So how do we ask for a judgment through rachamim and not justice and it be true? So I learned this from Rabbi David Foreman. So what is the question that Din asks? Right? Justice. Justice has a question.
What did you do?
What did you do? What have you done? Right? That is the question of justice. What have you done? Right? And then based on what you have done, that's what you get. Right? So that's a heavy question. What is the question of rachamim? So in order to understand the question of rachamim, you have to understand the root of the word. Right? Mercy. Rachamim. What's the root? Who knows the root of rachamim? Mm-hmm. Racham. Rechem, womb. The root is Rechem, womb. So a womb has to ask a question. The womb has to judge, right? Not every fertilized egg gets to implant in the womb. There's lots of miscarriages that happen very early on. Many people don't even know they had a miscarriage. It just seems like a late period, right? Where the womb actually checked out the viability of that zygote and said, no, I don't think so, right? And just let it go, right? So the womb is a judging organ, but it judges by a different question, right? The womb can't ask, what have you done? Because it did nothing, right? There's no history for that zygote. Instead, it asks, who can you become? Right? What is your potential? Who can you become? Are you worth me investing in? Are you worth me giving that time and energy, nutrition and discomfort to? Is it worth it to invest in you that you could become something great enough that I should give you that? Right? So it's a true question. It's a question based in truth. But it's a different question. So we're not saying, God, don't look at what I did. We're saying, God, look at who I can become. So how do we make a distance between what I have done and who I can become? Because we are, after all, just the sum of our choices, right? Every single day, every single hour, we make choices. And that's who we are in our essence, right? I mean, we're affected by our nature. And we are affected by our nurture. But we get to pick. That is part of being human, is we get to transcend both nature and nurture and actually choose who we want to be. So every choice that we make goes into who we are right now. We're only who we are because we chose ourselves into this place right here, right now. So maybe it's the same thing. Maybe who you can become is the sum of what you have done. But you want some distance between those two. Right? So how do you do that? How do you create that distance so that you can become somebody much more valuable than the addition of what you have done until now? And that is the coming together. That's the process of Elul and these Shiva de Nechemta weeks, these 7 weeks of consolation, these weeks of shifting perspective and looking at the coming close and trying to create relationships and repair breaches. It's all about, how do I shift what I have done and use that for fuel into who I can become? Right? I've done some bad things. I said not nice things about other people. I maybe paid cash without tax, right? Whatever it is, there's things that I have done that I'm not proud of. I was short-tempered with some people. Even if you didn't mean to be mean, I'll give you an example of some things you could think about, but I had a relatively simple-minded person, a pretty simple-minded person, called me to say she's working on a project and she'd like to publish it. She wants to know from me how you do that. I said, that's great. What project are you working on? She says, well, she's working on a cookbook and she'd like to be able to sell it in Walmart and Target where she sees other cookbooks are sold. So how am I going to tell her? Your cookbook is never going to sell in Walmart and Target. It's just not. Like, you're gathering your family's recipes. That's very nice. It's great for your family. But you're not going to... She says, well, I see other people's things are sold in Walmart and Target. How will I get mine there? I'd like to publish... First of all, how do I publish it? So I told her about photographers, and I told her about plating it, and I told her about writing it, and I told her about kitchen testing it, and right? But in the end, I did ask her, because I wanted her to think, and then I realized it was too harsh a question. So I just want her to think. I said, but why? And I told her that it's mostly celebrity chefs or people who have a show or people who have a product or people like that. That's who gets those books published and they're sold there. I said, but why will people care about your recipes? So she said, well, I care about my recipes. I said, of course you care about your recipes, but why will other people care about your recipes? Why do they want to buy it? Anyway, after I hung up the phone, I realized she didn't probably hear that question the way I meant it. I meant, like, from a marketing perspective, why will people care? And really, she's simple enough that she heard it as, like, why would people care about you? And I realized I shouldn't have said it that way at all. You know, and I realized I needed to call back and apologize and make sure that she didn't feel bad. Like, I didn't just tell her straight out, you can't, but I wanted to lead her to the understanding that it's probably not going to sell and let her put her time, and she's poor also, don't spend money on this because it's not going to pan out. Like, you need food. Don't go hiring a photographer, you know, when you don't have an empty refrigerator. So, but I said it in a way that she didn't understand easily, and I made sure to call back to apologize. So sometimes we have to think about it. I was giving her my time and my expertise and my thoughts, and I spent an hour on the phone with her, but I didn't say it nicely for her. So sometimes, even though you might be doing right things, it could end up wrong, and you have to smooth over or repair those kinds of things too. And that's
sometimes people don't heal what they should prepare.
Correct. So sometimes you have to know when not to say, right? And I have to learn that too. Like, just like to say, you know, that's such a great idea, collecting recipes. I don't know anything about publishing. You know, and that's it. Just say, done. So sometimes, it depends. So you're right. Some can't always hear. And people want to hear what they want to hear. So you're right. It's just part of the learning process. But sometimes we have to examine how we talk to somebody, even if we were talking to them in kindness, and make repairs. How much more so when we weren't speaking to somebody in kindness? We were short with somebody or curt with somebody or whatever it is. You know, when people call me and say, oh, can you donate to my this or to that? I just try to be polite. I say, you know, my tzedakah dollars are allocated for this year, but I wish you luck on your next call. So, and I don't like give them grief. I just say, I wish you luck on your next call. So, and if they start their speech, I just say, you know, I wish you luck on your next call. And I'll hang up then, but I just do wish them luck on their next call. So that's it. You don't have to be rude. So, so basically what we have to do then in order to create the distance between din and rachamim is to make that space inside ourselves, right? To examine what we've done, to do a cheshbon hanefesh, to do a calculation of the soul, to really sit down, and it pays to sit down in writing. Take out a piece of paper and think about all your different relationships. You might want to do categories of relationships. You know, think about, let's just say, from a female perspective, you're a daughter, a daughter-in-law, a mother, a sister, a granddaughter. You know, like, what are your relationships that you have? You're a coworker, you're a neighbor, you're a friend, you're a boss. Right? Write them all down. And then think about those orbits. How have I been towards my mother-in-law, towards my sister, towards my daughter, towards my daughter-in-law, towards my whatever it is? Like, is there something I need to repair there? And you can just take little notes. You know, I need to apologize for this. Oh, right, I owe that person $50 still. They made a birthday present collection for the whole family for Uncle Ted, and I never paid in my $50. Let me make sure I send that check, you know. As you go through it, you'll start to remember little things you have to do to repair, to fix. Oh, I still have that book that I borrowed from Aunt Sally. Let me make sure I give that back, right? This is the time to return the books and return the baking trays and pay your debts and make your apologies. And so that's on the one side. And then you think, how do I want to invest in those relationships? You know, I don't call my mother-in-law often enough. Let me put it on the calendar. I'm going to call her once a week this year, right? Like, I'm not going to call her every day. My husband does that. But, like, I want to make an effort. I want to put that in there. I want to invest in that relationship. Okay, maybe I don't want to call once a week. I'll send her a card, right? But I want to figure out an investment. How can I invest in this relationship? Maybe I have a neighbor I don't really talk to enough. So I can bring over, you know what? I'll bring a basket of apples and honey and say, Happy Rosh Hashanah. Like, I just want to invest in the relationship a little bit, make it so that there's a little more smoothness there. So repair and investments that we want to make, and to really look at who we are and what we've been thinking, how we've behaved this year, so that when we show up for our day of judgment, God can look at us and say, wow, I see what you've done, but I see the work and I see who you can become. You're really headed in a different direction, right? You can become somebody else then. You already have to start doing some thinking and making some different choices so that your potential is much greater than what you have done. Even if it's promises that you might not fulfill again, right? That happens to all of us where we start the year, we say, oh, I'm going to call her every single week, right? And 2 weeks later, you're too busy or it wasn't a pleasant conversation and you don't pick up the phone, right? So, all right, so you try it again.
But you might want to invest, but the other person might not want your investment.
That's true, too.
Right.
Right, right. So if that's the case, right, let's just pick a classic example of something like that. A daughter-in-law, right, may not be interested at all in your investment, okay? So it's not an investment if you're investing on your terms, right? So that's where it would pay to, let's say, get, I forgot his name, the author, he's a minister, did lots of work with people, the five love languages. What's her love language? Could you learn more about her? The five love languages, basically, according to him, being physical touch, words of encouragement, gifts, quality time. What's the other one? physical touch. Did I say that one?
Mm-hmm.
Physical touch, gifts, quality time, words of acts of service. Acts of service. Okay, those are the five love languages. What's her love language? Maybe it's a gift, right? Send her a gift. Maybe it's not yours. Maybe you're thinking acts of service. I'd like to babysit the kids. And she's thinking, I'd rather not have you babysit the kids, right? So that's not what she wants, right? So she likes gifts. You're not into gifts. She likes coach. You're not into coach. Send her a coach wallet, you know, Shana Tova, whatever it is. Like, that's an investment. Because not the investment you nest, but you want to invest somehow. It has to be an investment she can feel. Okay, just opens the door. But it might open the door. So it might pay. Maybe your investment this year is reading a few more books like that and not even talking to her about it, but just learning how are ways that I could connect that I haven't thought of, because what I've done so far hasn't worked. You know, so sometimes it does take expanding ourselves, and that's why God puts some of those people in our lives, right? Because who we are is only the distance between how we came in and how we exit. Right? Because how we come in with our learning abilities and disabilities, with our parents, with their money, you know, their socioeconomic standing in which we are raised, their standards that they gave us that we either achieve or don't achieve, the expectations, our community, our generation, our state even, right? Texas is different than Colorado. It was so nice. This morning I went to see the Capitol building in Austin. It's gorgeous, if anybody ever has a chance to go there. And it's huge. It's very Texas, right? But it's kept so, not all Capitol buildings are kept so nicely. It's kept impeccably. It's spotless, and all the wood is polished, and all the floors are shiny, and all the paint is fresh, and it's amazing, right? So Texans are born into a Texas energy, and Coloradans are born into a Colorado energy. All of that is just what you're given. And then the question is, what do you do with that? How do you grow with that? Because if you're really smart and really kind and really rich and you give a lot of tzedakah and you teach a lot of classes and you're just an amazing person and you die the same way, you really achieved nothing. You just did what you were programmed to do. Right? But if you're, you know, kind of medium and quick to anger, and even if you're really smart and kind and with a lot of money, it depends on where you give your money, right? You can fund the symphony, or you could fund Jewish day schools, whatever. Like, there's different choices you can make with what you are and what you have. And it's really only the choices that you make that you leave with. So,
meaning if you didn't grow.
Right. Because it's only the growth. So God loves you, it turns out. And so he gives difficult people to you as a present.
Thank you.
And sometimes, like that daughter-in-law, you could say, actually, I'd rather not have that present, right? When God knows you best and says, actually, I think you need this present because I'd like to see you grow this way, right? So I'm going to put this person in your life to sharpen you up that way. Now you can make a choice. I'm going to work on that. I'm not going to work on that, right? And then you could miss an opportunity. So,
but sometimes if it's not really wanted on the part of the other person, it's best to just move on, right?
So the question is, what's the opportunity? What is the opportunity? Sometimes the opportunity is how to move on and not feel insulted by that person not wanting you. Maybe that's the opportunity. Sometimes the opportunity is enduring patience. Wait 10 years. Wait 20 years. You know, I mean, I'm trying to think how I could tell this story with that. I had a family member who was not happy with my level of observance at all. It was way too much in the face of this person. And they felt like I was just in their face all the time. And it turns out that even if you're smart enough not to say this, which I was not smart enough not to say this as a 20-year-old, right? But even if you're smart enough not to say, you actually don't do that right, you don't keep that right, that's not the halacha, that's not kosher enough for me, right? Even if you're smart enough not to say that, just by living certain ways, you scream that at certain people. So if you keep Shabbos and your parents didn't, you're telling them on Shabbos when you don't answer the phone, you didn't raise me right, you didn't teach me right, you don't do it right, right? So it can cause problems in families, it turns out. So I was causing problems with a certain family member. She was having problems with me. But about, let's say, over a quarter of a century of knowing her, after about a quarter of a century, I became the only house in the family system that was kosher enough for her to eat in on Passover. Everybody else kind of dropped away. And even though I was the way too religious one, she did have standards, and I was the only one left. And a few years after that, that person gave me a very significant gift that was a family heritage gift. But that gift to me meant I won. I was patient enough and waited enough, and it was long enough that she finally saw that I'm on a good pathway. And I'm not really a threat. I'm really an assistance to carrying the whole thing forward. So, but it took a long time and a lot of waiting and a lot of tears. So, but it happened. So sometimes it could be that the lesson is enduring patience, right? And so sometimes you just have to wait. And sometimes you have to figure out different investments. And sometimes there's all kinds of things. Whatever it is, all those people that are causing you stress are gifts calling you forward to develop something in you that hasn't been developed yet.
Riding the wave.
Hmm?
You have to ride the wave.
Yes, you do. You have to actually get on it. Okay, so for that, I will tell you, let's see, shall I?
Go for it.
I'm going to tell you one more story of how difficult things can be, right, what you're supposed to, what Hashem is doing here. So we see in the 23rd Psalm two different descriptions of a stick. Right, so it says, Shiftecha u'mishantecha he'me'enachamuni. Your rod and your staff both comfort me. So a rod for a shepherd. It's about the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Right. So you have a rod. A rod is what the shepherd uses to whap the sheep back into the fold. Right. And the staff is what the shepherd uses for his support to go up the hill. So the staff is the same stick as the rod. One is used for whapping and one is used for support. That's the same stick that's used in two different ways. Okay, so what does that mean? So wasn't really sure. I'd learned some commentaries. Then one day I learned a commentary, and that plus a story from my youth totally shed light on it. So when I was in high school, I took ballet almost every day. I went to a performing arts high school, and we had a very full of herself ballet teacher, which is the appropriate type to have if you're in one of those performing arts high schools, right? So she walked around with her stick. We had a live pianist, and she had her stick, which she used for a lot of whapping, right? So depending on however you held your arm, your wrist, you know, and ballet dancers are not supposed to have a sagging elbow, no chicken wings in ballet, right? It's supposed to be up, your shoulder's supposed to be down, your elbow's supposed to be up, hands not dropping, right? Your fingers in the right position, and she would be all over you with that stick, right? Whap your shoulders, whap your elbow, whap your wrist, whap your tush, whap your knees, whap, 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 right? So one day, and she'd walk all around the room and just give everybody little whaps. So one day we had a new student in the class, and she did not know how to stand at all, right? And the teacher was all over her. Whap, whap, whap. One person, 20 whaps, you know? And pretty soon she broke down in tears. She started to cry, how come you're hitting me so much? Right? And so the teacher stopped the pianist, and she came over to her. She said, why are you crying? She said, you're hitting me so much. It's not fair. You're constantly hitting me. She said, don't you cry when I correct you. Don't you cry when I correct you. She said, I correct you because I see potential. She said, you cry the day I stop. And then she started the music again. So I learned from that sometimes being hit is a sign of affection, right? Sometimes it's saying, I see in you something that could be better, and I want to bring it out. And so that's the way she did it. She was too full of herself. That's the truth. Nevertheless, that story helped me understand that psalm when it's thy rod and thy staff both comfort me. So the shepherd uses the stick in both the ways, but we're talking to God. It's a parable, right? So we're saying, God, the stick that you use with me, the one that I lean on and I'm strengthened through, and the one that you hit me with are both forms of engagement that are there to bring out the best in me. And I appreciate it. They both comfort me because you see potential and you want to bring it out of me. So the difficult people in our lives, those are people to make investments with, even if it's only inside ourselves. How can I learn more? How to be more patient and tolerant with that person in my life? How to see them as somebody who's also growing, who also has challenges, and allow them to be on their journey while I'm on mine. You know, so there's all kinds of things that we could be learning about all these difficult people around us, but the whole trick is really to get to a place where when we get to Rosh Hashanah, using this month's energy to be able to get to a place where we say, God, don't judge me out of justice. Judge me out of rachamim. Who can I become? I have a lot of potential. I could become somebody amazing this year. Please give me that chance. So that's what we want to accomplish during this month, is to shift our perspective and shift God's perspective about us to show that we could become somebody amazing. And there you go. If you have any questions, you could ask any questions, but I wanted to kind of end on time in case people want to go. So
do you teach
in Colorado? I travel a lot like this, about every 3 or 4 weeks to different communities. And then I teach every week in Colorado. Monday mornings I have 2 classes back-to-back. Monday nights occasionally a class. And then if I'm home, I fill in for other teachers around.
Do you teach at a Jewish community center?
Mm-hmm. I teach all around, in different synagogues and community centers. And sometimes people call me a Federation luncheon or whatever. So I, you know, depending on what people want. And some private families have learning circles that I do for the family. So it really depends on, you know, who calls me and for what. So I have a regular series that I teach, and then and I have a website, abiteoftorah.com, and I have all my recordings on there, all free, so you can listen to
A Bite of Torah.
A Bite of Torah. Because I don't have the whole thing.
B-I-T-E.
T-O-R-A-H. Yep. Yeah. I was just saying, I don't have the whole Torah, I just have a bite. So that's what I share.
A Bite of Torah.